Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the Roundtable Plus webinar on India Budget 2015, Hits and Misses for Global Investors. This event is being organized by Nishith Desai Associates in association with U.S. India Business Council, USIBC. The speakers are Shreya Rao, Co-Head International Tax Practice and Head Private Client Practice, Nishith Desai Associates. Rushir Sinha, Co-Head Private Equity and M&A, Nishith Desai Associates. Karan Kalra, Co-Head Banking and Finance, Nishith Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participants' lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. If you should need assistance during this conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star and zero on your touchtone telephone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishith Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Androids, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand over the session to Ms. Shreya Rao. Thank you. And over to you, ma'am.
Actually, to Richard Sinha.
All right. So, yeah. So, welcome to those of you on the call. So, as I was saying, for the first time, we are having a government which is having majority, a super majority, not just at the federal level, but also at the state level. And this is a prime minister who's shown promise. And a lot of and the ability to attract significant amount of foreign investment when he was the chief minister of the state of Gujarat. And I think he was elected on a lot of promise, probably something like what Obama had when he was here, but I think he should probably do a better job than what Obama did. And some of the reflections that I think we are already seeing a lot of India interest coming back. Some of the indicators could be like, say, the stock market, which has kind of grown about 30% in the past 9 months, ever since the government came into power. We were just meeting a couple of our friends in the law firm fraternity, and one of them said that, just in the past month, they've seen India-focused fund formation mandates. So I think, stock market, fund formation, et cetera, these are some of the indicators which are kind of showing that, India is again becoming, attractive from a foreign investment perspective. And it was in this slide, that the finance minister gave the budget speech. And, just for your information, the Minister of State for Finance, who's kind of very closely aligned with the Finance Minister, is Mr. Jayant Sinha. And he's been responsible for a lot of the provisions that you have in the budget today. And he's himself a fund manager. He used to run OMIDR and his wife is a fund manager. So, you have for a change a finance minister or a finance team which kind of understands private equity, foreign capital and all of that. And the budget speech kind of resonated the sentiment that if India has to grow, foreign capital is critical, tax and regulatory certainty is critical. And this budget kind of sets the direction on how we need to achieve this, and it sets out a significant amount of tax and regulatory measures in which we will discuss, which will probably pave the way, in times to come for a sustained economic growth and also kind of higher foreign investments. So I think very quickly to introduce on my left is, Shreya Rao. She co-heads our international tax practice, and I co-head the private equity and the M&A practice, also do a little bit of private debt and real estate. On my right is Karan Kalra. He is a senior with the private equity M&A practice, also co-leads the banking and finance initiative, and also does a lot of debt and real estate as well. So maybe, Shreya, I could just probably start off with you. From a tax perspective, I think the two big major changes have been GAR and indirect transfers. Maybe you want to just explain how it works.
Sure. So So I haven't had the opportunity to meet all of you in this room, but I did get a few, you know, cards from people who I think work with funds in New York. So what we're going to do over the course of this session is, of course, there are several sectors that will be impacted and, you know, several different changes that have come in. But what we're going to do is really focus on some of the changes that could impact funds and the private equity sector in particular. And I think the general anti-avoidance rule and the indirect transfer provisions are two of the most major changes that have come through the budget. And the general anti-avoidance rule and the indirect transfer provisions, both were introduced in 2012. They were significantly criticized at that point in time. Because if we rewind, most of you would recall that the Indian economy was doing very well in the few years prior to that, even though the whole world was in a recession stage. So what happened at the Indian political level is that the finance ministry and the government in general believed that irrespective of the kinds of tax measures that they introduced on ground, the economy would still be buoyant, right? So what happened is that in 2012, in January 2012, in fact, Vodafone got a successful ruling at the Supreme Court level in respect of its offshore transfer of effectively a controlling stake in an Indian entity, right? I'm guessing most of you are familiar with the facts, but if not, please do let me know and I'll stop and we'll go into it in a little bit more detail. But what happened immediately after the Supreme Court ruling in Vodafone is that there were certain provisions introduced into the Finance Act which said that if there is a transfer of an offshore company, even if it is between non-residents, that could be subject to tax in India if the offshore entity derives substantial value from India, right? Now, what they intended this to attack is the kinds of, you know, transfers of controlling interest which would have taken place in Vodafone. And this isn't unusual, you know, in a lot of countries, for example, in the U.S., you have FERTPA-related provisions where when you're transferring real estate, you get taxed irrespective of whether you transfer the land directly or a company that owns that land, right? So there are targeted provisions like this in other countries as well. And India was trying to set something of that sort in place. But what happened is that because the provisions were introduced so soon after the Supreme Court judgment, they didn't really have the time to work out the specifics or the nuances of it, right? So the provision that finally came into place in the law was so wide that it covered all sorts of unanticipated situations, right? So the first issue was, how do you define whether an offshore company has substantial value in India or not? The percentage of value was unclear. Should it be that the Indian entity contributes 50% value or 30% or 20%? Where really would the threshold lie? The law didn't deal with that at all. The second issue was, how do you measure substantiality? So do you measure it on the basis of a DCF sort of valuation? Would it be book value? Or in the context of U.S. entities with Indian subsidiaries, particularly in the outsourcing sector, what often used to happen is that a substantial chunk of employees would be in India, right? So would that be substantial? All of this was completely unclear. Then the next aspect that was unclear is that they didn't really define transfer in a manner that would be specific or restrictive enough. So you would find situations where you would have a U.S.-listed company and shares of a listed company would be transferred on the exchange, and that could still trigger Indian tax consequences, right? In another example, you could pledge shares of a U.S. company in the U.S. and to a U.S. bank, and that could trigger indirect transfer tax consequences. And nobody anticipated this. I mean, this is completely counterintuitive, right? If you are a U.S. resident and your asset is a U.S.-based company and you're dealing with a U.S.-based buyer, why would you ever imagine Indian tax would apply? And people were just not prepared for this. And what this did to deal-making is that at some point in time, private equity players and funds realized that this was a problem. And what we saw is that at least 30% of time in the course of a deal was being dedicated to negotiating tax indemnities instead of discussing the commercials of a deal. Right? So deal-making completely stopped. People became very conservative. and it was a huge issue as far as investments into India and India-focused M&As were concerned, right? When the government came in, and this happened last year, there was a budget prior to this, which was, you know, towards the second half of last year, where it was expected that some of these issues would be addressed because evidently international investors were very concerned about it. And the elephant in the room wasn't dealt with in the last... this wasn't addressed in the last budget, but in this one, what they've done is they've solved some of the simpler issues. So firstly, they've defined substantiality. They've said it should be at least 50% of the value being derived from an Indian asset. And it's expected that they'll put in place some kind of measuring mechanism by way of rules. The second thing that they've done is they've provided a list of exemptions. So portfolio transfers below the range of 5% don't get covered. Mergers don't get covered at the offshore level. So they basically try to fine-tune the provision, right? Now, there are some big open issues that are still out there. And I think the key open issue really is that they haven't addressed how to deal with an adjustment of cost basis, right? Now, what this means is that if you buy an asset today and you sell an asset tomorrow, then if there is a subsequent sale of that asset, your cost is then the sale price, right? So if you buy an asset at 10, sell it at 20, and then there's a subsequent sale at the value of 30, on your second sale, your gain is computed as 30 minus 20 and not 30 minus 10, right? So that's called an adjustment of cost basis. If any tax provision, capital gains provision has to work, that adjustment of cost basis has to be factored in. And these provisions don't factor that in, and they don't deal with the issue of how the provision would apply if there is a multi-tier structure, right? So suppose U.S. owns Mauritius, owns India, and there's a transfer at the U.S. level and this tax is levied, and then there's a transfer at the Mauritius level and the tax is levied. How does the adjustment mechanism work hasn't been dealt with. So a little bit of fine-tuning is still required, but at least the intentions are good. They're looking at this as a real issue and they're trying to resolve it. Now, that's as far as the technical position on indirect transfers goes. I think from a fund industry perspective, this is going to be very significant for two or three reasons. The first is that, so for participatory note holders, P note holders at the offshore level, there was always this question of, you know, if the substantial value of the fund is derived from Indian assets, whether P note holders have to then be subject to Indian tax requirements. And there's good news and bad news for them. The good news is that since there's a 5% threshold now, there are some situations where there will be clarity on when the tax applies. But the bad news is that 5% is all that they've dealt with as far as the limits are concerned. So if it's an India-focused hedge fund, you'll still have an open issue if there's more than 5% being transacted, right? A couple of other situations where, for example, if the fund does a direct exit at the India level, they haven't really given clarity on treaty entitlement. So if you have a Mauritius-based vehicle selling this Indian interest, that's still an open point. That's not been addressed yet in this budget. I think that's as far as the indirect transfers are concerned, unless you guys want to add something.
I think one more comforting thing has been the test of proportionality.
Yeah.
Because, you know, earlier what used to happen is that if they were able to establish that offshore entity kind of derives substantial value from Indian assets, then the offshore company shares were seen as if they were Indian company shares and they were entirely taxed, even though there may be many multiple offshore assets in that. So the entire thing got taxed in it. And now they've said to the extent of, you know, your tax of the offshore company's shares will be proportional to the extent that they hold the Indian asset. So you're having the proportionate threshold and not the entire thing being taxed in India. I think the other point is on general anti-avoidance rules.
I think the second key point is, and like Richard said, the government is sending out a very strong message that they want to provide tax certainty, right? And if any of you followed the election in India when this new government came into power, their manifesto contained a very strong message, which I think in the history of Indian politics is the first time ever that a political party has come out and said that they are against tax terrorism, right? Now, this statement in the manifesto was very clearly directed towards proposals like the general anti-avoidance rule and the indirect transfer provision, which resulted in a lot of criticism for the previous government. And what this budget has done is, firstly, it has postponed the application of the general anti-avoidance rule. And the significance of this is that unlike some countries like the US, where there are judicial principles of substance over form, which means that a court can look at a transaction and say that although the both parties have come together and, you know, described their form as being, you know, something, we actually think the commercial substance of this is something else, and we are going to recharacterize this transaction. India doesn't follow that approach. So India says, I'm going to respect the document that you've put in place unless it looks like it's a sham, unless it looks like it's fraudulent, right? So it's a much lower threshold in terms of disregarding transactions in comparison to some other countries. And what the general anti-avoidance rule does is it gives the tax authorities the power to recharacterize, right? And several countries are looking at this today, but the real concern with the Indian guard was that tax authorities in India tend to be a lot more aggressive than tax authorities in other jurisdictions. To an extent, this is a procedural issue, because when the center had a huge current account deficit and it was trying to hike its revenue targets, it would pass on those targets to the tax collection authorities, and they would also be incentivized on the basis of how much they collected. So you would find this very, you know, perverse situation where beginning January every year, you would start getting very high-pitched assessments. In fact, on a lighter vein, I got an assessment a couple of years ago where they wanted me to pay some, you know, substantial additional tax. And as a tax lawyer, I don't really like going home and looking at my own assessment order, so I paid the amount. And then I took it to my chartered accountant and I said, why has this happened? Because you did go through all of my records. And she said, have you even read the order? And I said, no, I haven't. They had assessed an additional amount on the basis that I was male. And in India, you have lower taxes. You have a higher threshold if you're female. So you don't really need to pay that additional tax. And I said, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. But, you know, sometimes the assessments are really that strange. And what they've tried to do is that, when tax authorities are given a tool like the general anti-avoidance rule, as a taxpayer, what you would want is the certainty that it will be applied fairly and it will not be used to harass taxpayers, right? And that was really the concern. Because today, when you deal with international businesses, very often a lot of them are happy paying a certain amount of tax, which they will factor in as a business cost. But what they are not happy with is uncertain taxes, unexpected taxes, and taxes which are levied without any real legal basis, right? So those are the kinds of situations which really get people worried. So if you retrospectively amend the provision going back to 1961, it's going to freak people out. And what they've done is they've postponed the guard for 2 years. But what is even more positive is that they have said that they are going to grandfather all investments that take place prior to 2017, right? Now, why this is a big deal is because they're giving adequate notice to foreign investors and to other investors, saying that you have until 2017 to set your affairs straight. If you make any investments after 2017, which appear problematic from a substance perspective, then the tax authorities have the right to recharacterize. But if you've made any investments prior to 2017, we're not going to look at those because we realize that a business needs time to readjust its mechanism, right? Hugely positive measure. Now, as far as funds are concerned, the one qualification that I have to include over here is that you can have a fund structure that is in place prior to 2017, which makes investments after 2017, right? So if the investments are made after 2017, you would still be covered, irrespective of whether the fund is set up prior to 2017. So that's one thing you need to keep in mind. But otherwise, as far as your existing investments are concerned, it doesn't matter. If your exit is after 2017, you're still protected as far as the guard is concerned.
So I think just on the same point, There's always this huge debate on Mauritius versus Singapore versus Netherlands.
Yeah.
And that debate is mostly triggered in light of GAR.
Yeah.
And how do you establish substance? And somewhere down the line, the perception seems to be that, you know, Singapore is always the best choice.
Yeah.
So how do you, so, you know, how does this change? I mean, obviously, GAR's from 2017.
Yeah.
But how should one plan their affairs on the choice of jurisdiction also even today?
Yeah, I think that's what we really call a million-dollar question, because we have a lot of funds that, you know, have the same question today. And I think there, our response has been that, so if you look at the history of the Mauritius Treaty, right, there have been challenges to the Mauritius Treaty every year since the early 2000s, right? There was a Supreme Court decision in 2003-2004 in the case of Azadi Bachao Andolan, which incidentally we did. So we appeared at the Supreme Court level in relation to that case. But the fact is that Mauritius has always been a contentious route for a very long time. This in itself does not mean that the treaty is going to be changed over tomorrow, or that there's going to be a change in the way in which tax benefits apply under that treaty. But what has changed since the early 2000s is that India is a lot more particular in relation to substance today in comparison to the early 2000s, right? So I think from a fund context, the question that we often get is that if a fund has historically set up a Mauritius structure, should they move that structure to Singapore or should they continue with Mauritius? And on that point, the response would be that if you have a historical structure in place, it absolutely does not make sense to move over to Singapore, because today, from a substance perspective, what you want to be able to demonstrate is that there is a business purpose, a non-tax purpose for your having the structure in place, right? If you have set up a structure in Mauritius historically and you are moving it over to Singapore, then you will need to work hard to be able to demonstrate that non-tax reason, because you will inevitably have a lot of records indicating that you're moving to Singapore from a GAR or a substance perspective, right? Now, that raises the second question, right, which is that if you are in a fund formation stage today, you're setting up an investment vehicle today, should you choose a Singapore or should you choose a Mauritius? And on that point, the response would be that if you're setting up a new structure, Singapore sometimes makes sense. And the reason for this is that substance requirements are only likely to increase as the years go on. And if you need to have personnel in a jurisdiction, right, if you want a fund manager to go and live somewhere, it's much likelier that they'll be happier going to Singapore rather than going to Mauritius. Of course, we have seen a couple of cases that people have relocated to Mauritius, but, you know, that always makes people smile and they're like, what kind of a fund manager would want to go live there? But that's in a lighter vein. I think if you want to hire people in a jurisdiction, Singapore is just going to be easier for you. So new investment structures, Singapore is definitely a good decision.
Why do you not include Dubai?
So
Dubai,
that's a very good question. That is correct. So I think, so that's a very good question, and thanks for that. I think there have really been two issues with Dubai, right? And we've seen it being used as a holding jurisdiction for strategic purposes. And very often when we're looking at investments into Africa, Dubai would, for example, be a very good jurisdiction when there are outbound investments. But we've not really seen funds prefer Dubai as a holding jurisdiction. And there are three or four reasons for this, right? The first is that I think there's still a little bit of apprehension about the political certainty of investments made through a Dubai vehicle. People aren't really sure how long this the tax exemption benefit will continue, and how long they'll be able to take advantage of lower tax rates in Dubai. So that's one issue. The second issue is that the UAE-India treaty doesn't have the same kind of capital gains benefit that a Mauritius or a Singapore treaty would. So that portion of tax planning from a fund perspective doesn't always work out. So we have seen some hedge funds that have looked at Dubai, because if your income is characterized as business income, you can still take advantage of the permanent establishment provision in the treaty. But as of last year, this is, again, no longer a viable option because India has introduced a law, a provision, that says even for a hedge fund kind of investment, and we don't use the term hedge fund, but they said for an FPI kind of investment, it would be characterized as capital gain. So you would need to look at a treaty like Mauritius, Singapore, Netherlands, which has that capital gain benefit worked in.
So basically, India, Singapore, and India, Mauritius, under their treaty, have a provision that if there are capital gains on sale of the shares of an Indian company, then the capital gains will be taxed only in Singapore or in Mauritius. And in both these countries, there is no capital gains tax. So the tax liability on sale of shares becomes 0%. But if you are a Dubai entity and you sold the shares of an Indian company, there is no provision with respect to capital gains, and therefore India would tax it typically at the rate of, you know, if it is short-term or long-term, at the maximum, at the maximum marginal rate.
Which could be between 0 to 40%, depending on the holding period and the nature of the investment.
And I think just to add to that, we've seen UAE being used actually on the debt side, and a number of banks with presence, you know, Indian banks doing ECBs into India,
yeah,
do actually use the UAE treaty because, A, there is the convenience of having, I think there's a 0% under the UAE as far as interest withholding.
There is a 12.5%. So the interest, so typically when an Indian company pays interest on rupee-denominated bonds, there is a 40% interest. There's a 40% withholding tax, which gets reduced to 12.5% when the recipient is a Dubai entity. So
again, on these banks, right, the point I was making, so yes, there is no domestic tax and it's only 12.5% withholding, so you take your cost of transaction to be that. The problem and or the advantage that the banks had, the ones I'm referring to really, had the ability to actually shift around who the lender was, right? So the Indian law looks at who the eligible lender is, and if the bank had a branch in Bahrain or it had one in UAE or for that matter in the States, it was one and the same thing. They had the ability to shift the debt, so if the political situation there was such that it wasn't ideal, these benefits were not to continue, you could switch them over. We actually some time ago did analyze this for other investors coming in looking at private debt, but just the uncertainty wasn't very comfortable because in a private debt situation or a non-bank loan situation, you don't have the ability to juggle around jurisdiction, change the holder of the securities. So those have really been the pain points.
So from a debt perspective, Dubai kind of still works, but not from an equity perspective. I think the on the Mauritius versus Singapore debate, while Singapore is obviously better off from the point of view of you being able to set up your substance, your manager and all of that, and Singapore also gives you fund exemptions under the Singapore Income Tax Act. If you spend about $200,000 annually, the Singapore government gives you exemptions, you know, for the fund from domestic taxes, both at the fund level and also the manager level. So it's, because Singapore is also evolving as a good fund regime. But in many cases, we face challenges in Singapore in terms of the capital structure, because how do you structure it? If you structure it as loan, then paying any upside on loan is subject itself to a withholding of 15%. If there's redemption, then there are redemption of shares out of capital, you know, has got, criminal implications if you're not solvent and all of that. So, you know, we've been through that cycle. And there's a lot of compliance issues. And also, it's a little expensive jurisdiction. Vis-a-vis that, for some of the smaller funds, many people might still choose Mauritius. And as Shreya said, the trick to GAR is to demonstrate that your non-tax reasons of choosing their jurisdiction are more dominant than choosing your tax, for the tax purposes. So when you are setting up, let's say, a Mauritius entity, you should demonstrate that, you know, there was a non-tax reason for it. Like, for instance, it has got a very good corporate law regime, which is extremely flexible. The Mauritius India has a bilateral investment treaty, which allows you to sue the Republic of India if there's anything, you know, if there's expropriation or anything of that sort, which, let's say, U.S. India treaty does not have. So you need to demonstrate the non-tax reasons in a more dominant way, and ensure that this is well documented in the incorporation documents, etc., so that tomorrow if you're questioned, you have adequate protections.
So there's an interesting statistic on that, by the way. So I'm not sure how many people in this room are aware of bilateral investment treaties, but they are these treaties of, they started out as treaties of friendship, right, where one country said to the other that if residents of your country invest into my country, I will give them investment protection and I will treat them in the same manner as my residents. Right? So this is basically the genesis of an investment protection treaty. So India has several of these in place and they've been around for a while, but we didn't have a single bilateral investment treaty claim, or I think we had one in the context of Enron, until about 2011 or 12. Since 2011 or 12, there have been at least 5 or 6 which have been reported in the media, right? And that raises the question as to why is this happening? Why are there suddenly investment protection treaty claims? And one of the reasons for that is that post-2012, or at least between 2012 to 2014, there was a lot of regulatory and policy flip-flops, right? So the government was changing its stand on things that were historically established. On the regulatory front, corporate law front, tax front, there were several issues that were coming up. So, for example, in the context of the telecom companies who had their licenses cancelled, because there was a statement that they were improperly assigned, a lot of those companies went ahead to file these bilateral investment treaty claims. Now, as a fund that's putting in capital into a country, what you would need to say when you're, putting this capital in is that returns are something that you look at a later point in time, right? Before you get returns, you want to first ensure that your capital is protected. That is your primary aim as someone who's putting in money, and returns only come after that. So if you look at the order of precedence, a bilateral investment treaty would be a very valuable protection to have, if only because it enables you to approach the government and say that there's been a violation. And that's really what Richard is mentioning, that you would need to look at documenting carefully in your board minutes as well as other documents that you put in.
And I think one more jurisdiction which is kind of coming up, I'll just come to you. One more jurisdiction which is coming up in a big way is Netherlands. Because earlier, we used to say Singapore, Mauritius, and Cyprus. Cyprus, because it has got the same capital gains benefits like Singapore and Mauritius, but Cyprus is also very good with respect to debt, because an Indian company paid interest to a Cypriot entity, the 40% withholding tax rates reduced to only 10%, and Cyprus domestic rates were also 10%, so you got full credit for it. But after what has happened in Cyprus, Cyprus is obviously out, and a lot of investor base has moved to Netherlands, and we'll be using the Dutch co-op vehicle for investments into India, because when a capitalizing a Dutch co-op is easy, because when a Dutch co-op pays to, its unit holders, whether by way of dividends or by way of interest, there is no withholding in Netherlands. So it's a more tax-optimized way of upstreaming. And when a Dutch entity invests into an Indian entity, and if the holding is more than 10%, then if it sells to a non-resident the shares of an Indian company, there is no tax in India. There is only capital gains tax in Netherlands, and there is 0% capital gains tax in Netherlands. So it has the benefit of a 10% withholding, just like Cyprus, and has got a good capital gains benefit, just like Singapore or Mauritius, but then it's selling to a non-resident. Only challenge is that if you're selling it to an Indian resident back, then there is an Indian tax consequence, which in a public company case would be about 10%. And it works pretty well for hedge fund or portfolio managers, because if you're holding an Indian company is less than 10%, then there's no tax in India again. There's only capital gains tax in Netherlands, where it will be 0% again. So, these are the 2 or 3 jurisdictions, and, all of you will have these books, and while I'm speaking, I think it might help. So let me just guide you through, some of these books. This blue book here is private equity and private debt, and it sets out all the jurisdictions. So if you look at page 25, it sets out India versus Mauritius and all of that, if you guys want to read about it.
I think there's a question there.
Yeah.
Personally
not, because I think Cyprus is one country which I think the Indian tax bodies think they've just got it. They are anyways kind of trying to survive through the banking crisis and everything, so we don't see much of fresh capital coming in. Whatever existing capital is trapped in, I think the tax authorities just think that, you know, let's tax it to the maximum marginal rate and make as much money out of it. That's been the approach, and that is why they've been totally resistant to any kind of negotiation with Mauritius, even though they have been quite cooperative, honestly, in terms of sharing whatever they have to.
Although I think in the Cyprus context, so there's not an official communication on this, but what really happened with Cyprus is that India is emphasizing very strongly on information exchange today. So every country it has a treaty with, and several countries which it has tax information exchange arrangements with, it's putting a lot of pressure on them to share information and cooperate. And I think what led to the Cyprus issue, aside from, I mean, of course, the banking crisis was also going on then, but I believe India requested for some information which Cyprus refused to share, which is why these, you know, the withholding provisions were then put in place, similar to the FATCA provisions which exist in the U.S. today. And there was some unofficial communication a few months ago that Cyprus has now come on board and is willing to share information. But again, nothing official on that yet. So unless something really major happens, I would agree with Richard that status quo will continue.
I think, you know, Shreya, just one more point before I touch on the regulatory side with you, Karan, is, you know, on this place of effective management.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that's kind of scaring a lot of people. Maybe we'll just talk a bit about that.
Yeah, and I think this is actually one of the more major changes in this budget. Although the real implications will span multiple sectors, so it'll impact carried investment planning for fund managers. It'll impact private wealth planning for individuals. It'll impact inversion structures that Indian promoters put in place to, you know, to expand offshore and to grow into global companies. And what this provision does is it changes the residency rule for Indian companies. Right? So an Indian resident company today is taxable on its global income. Like an Indian resident individual, the company would be taxable on its global income. Now the question is that when you look at a corporate entity like a company, how do you determine what residence is? And historically, India used to have two tests. One was the place of incorporation. So you set up a company in India, it's automatically an Indian resident. And the second was the whole control and management test. So if you set up a company in an offshore country and it was wholly controlled and managed from India, India would look at it as an Indian resident company. And we have a lot of case law on how residence was looked at in the context of these offshore companies. So one of the more well-known cases dealt with a situation where there was a Singapore entity. It was 100% owned by Indian residents. And there were two directors for that company. One was an Indian resident who was the key decision maker, and one was a nominee director in Singapore. And this case went to the tribunal, and the tribunal had to figure out whether this was an Indian resident company or not. And even in that case, they said it was not wholly controlled and managed in India, and not an Indian resident company, because this nominee director outside always left open the possibility of you know, certain decisions being blocked. So that's the approach that courts have historically taken. Now what has changed is that they have introduced a place of effective management test, which means that if your key decision makers sit in India, there is a possibility that the offshore company will be looked at as an Indian resident. Right? Now what does this do? If you look at any kind of company which is looking at expanding globally, right? And Indian companies do this very often for non-tax reasons a lot of the times, because we have exchange control regulations in place, right? So if you have an Indian company that's growing very fast, and several companies today in the tech sector, pharma sector, you know, services sector, all of these guys are growing very fast, they find that if all of their value is aggregated in India, it's very difficult for them to expand globally, right? So what they'll do is they'll flip their structure over. They'll invert their structure, which is something that has been happening in the U.S. as well. Except that in India, it happens for non-tax reasons, unlike in the U.S. where inversions are often tax-driven. Right? So what will then happen is that you will transfer out contracts, you will transfer out value-generating activities to that offshore vehicle, so that cash accumulates at the offshore level and can be used for global acquisitions. Right? But the promoters and, you know, the shareholders will still continue to be in India. Now, all of these kinds of structures are suddenly at risk, right? Because your decision makers are sitting in India. Similarly, for fund management, carried interest vehicles, where you may set up personal holding companies offshore, you now need to look more carefully at how that personal holding company is controlled and managed from India. Similarly, for private wealth structures, and what often happens when Indian residents want to buy property offshore, right, is that because we have restrictions on how much currency people can send out in a given year, and currently it's, so there was news that it would be raised to $250,000, but that's still not been notified. So what typically happens is that if you want to buy a property for a couple of million dollars, then you do need a pooling vehicle outside. You just cannot make this investment directly, right? So you would set up a company offshore, send out your yearly remittances, pool them in that company, and then take leverage at that offshore company level, and then service that loan out of your liberalized remittance proceeds every year. Very standard structure, again, non-tax driven, right? All of these structures are now going to be looked at more carefully. And what you would need to ensure is, firstly, that your board meetings happen outside India if you want to, you know, stay within the purview of the residency test. And make sure that if you can have key decision makers sitting outside India, that would be the best case. But at minimum, your board meetings should be outside India, and you should not have CEOs or those kinds of personnel in India.
Yeah. You have a question?
Thank you for your brilliant insight on the specific issues. The theme of the evening is risk for methods.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to request all three of you to tell us and share with us what, according to you, is the biggest risk and what is the one with the biggest risk. And if the risk has happened, do you see any regrets of that in each of them?
Sure. Do you want to take that now? Or do you want to do it?
Maybe.
Maybe some more and we can summarize that at the end. Sure we have our personal favorites.
So I think,
I'll get to that.
This, this is a tax hotline that you have there. This kind of summarizes all the hits and misses. And at the last page, it actually talks about the misses in particular, right? But let us first talk about the hits. Right, in whatever form, although Shreya talked about, is probably the biggest miss according to me, because that is going to make aggressive tax officers even more aggressive, because when the language was wholly controlled, then also they were so aggressive, and now when it's just moved to just a control threshold, I think there'll be probably a lot of aggressiveness. But it kind of sets that up. But let's kind of discuss the other major measures, and then we could kind of move over to the other stuff. I think the other point, Shreya has been on fund managers trying to relocate back to India, because it's a pretty funny state that we are in. There are India-focused funds, and there are India-focused managers, but yet, merely because they're pooling offshore capital, they need to be stationed outside India.
Yeah.
So
there's also been a change on that, and here I think this is again one of the messages that the Indian government has tried to communicate, right? They've said that they want investors to be able to do in India anything that they would be able to do in the US or in the UK. So that's the benchmark that they've set for themselves. I won't say it's all possible today. Of course, there's a lot of ground that has to be covered. But at least in terms of a benchmark, in terms of what they're trying to go towards, it's a positive benchmark, right? And I think the fund manager exemption is something that they tried to look at, from the UK. So the UK today has a permanent establishment exemption for fund managers who are situated in the UK. And India was trying to replicate that to some extent in the domestic law. Again, very well-intentioned, but of course there are a couple of issues with it. So firstly, what they've done is the conditions that they've put down for eligible funds who can avail of this exemption are very rigorous. So, for example, one of the conditions is that the eligible fund should have at least 25 members, right? Now, if you look at a standard master feeder kind of structure, or even if you look at a broad-based foreign portfolio investor, which is really where this 25-member requirement has come in from, on a regulatory side, you would measure 25 on a look-through basis, right? So if you have an institution, or if you have a bunch of institutions and they have multiple investors behind them, that would still qualify as broad-based from a regulatory perspective. But the tax provisions have not really made that distinction. So today, if you have a couple of institutions who are the key investors in this fund, you will not be considered an eligible fund for the tax exemption, purpose. So that's a real dampener. It's going to make this provision useless to some extent, both for private equity funds, which are very often likely not to have 25 members, and I would say even for hedge funds, because even if they do have 25 members on a look-through basis, they may not really have it at the investing entity level, because they may need to pool their investments or have some kind of an SPV that's making these investments. So not quite an effective measure. And I think what's happened here is that, like Richard mentioned, Jayant Sinha has a fund, fund background, and he does understand the sector. What would have probably happened is that he would have communicated to the people writing this legislation that, we're trying to work towards a permanent establishment exemption, but it didn't quite turn up on paper the way we expected it to.
Yeah.
So I see the way it is today a very good intention to them, but we probably need to see some work for it to really be used. At least for the industry.
Yeah. So, great. So, I think that has at least been a good intention, that they're trying to get fund managers to India. The language hasn't been the way we thought it to be, but I think it's because the revenue has its own mind, and sometimes the revenue secretary is not as aligned with the finance minister, even though the finance minister has, and we've seen that because in several associations and the representations, we've seen that, the finance minister has actually gone ahead and said, look, this is not what we wanted. This is exactly what happened in the last budget, and this time they went ahead and tried to provide more clarity to say that, the finance minister very clearly said that fund managers being in India should not fit permanent establishment, yet the text that ultimately comes out has such has such provision that kind of reduces the entire provision to the intent of redundancy. I think another big one has been that the corporate taxes in India will be slashed from 30% to 25%, and that's a big measure coming in from the government over the past, and it will happen in a staggered phase. So over the next 4 years, probably from 30 it will become to 25. I think current just quickly on the on the regulatory side. What do you see as, some of the critical measures?
Sure. So, and I think I'll start with your question that, what I think. I think the biggest message and the biggest boon of this budget has been the message that's been sent out, right? The message has been sent out in the words of the Prime Minister that they should, let's make in India. The message is there, let's make doing business in India easy.
We agree, as long as we agree.
So, it's doing making business easy in India. It's been trouble. We've seen the global rankings. We've been at 120, 130. I saw one at 75, and then I realized it's authored by the ruling government, someone related to that, and it was a stupid paper as far as I'm concerned. But that's where we were, and that message needs to change, right? So you need changes where the big pain points are what foreign investors are facing were on the regulatory side, right? This is what they did. So they've come up and told you, look, we're going to allow and make this easier. The first thing we're going to do is give you a single window. Now, these are proposals, and it's going to take time to implement, but you don't need to run from door to door and window to window to get your approvals done to do business. It takes a while. Well, it does. We're going to try and reduce this time frame, so you need to go to one person in one window and get your approvals, whether it's setting up your company or getting your basic approvals to run a shop. What happens next? What happens next is, well, it's going to take time to get implemented. What they're going to do before that is they promise to give us a standstill environment where they say, and this one I think is big, they say that, look, if you fall within the standstill criteria, we have a basic framework laid out, go ahead and do business without your approvals. Start making the applications, do them in time. And that's big for foreign investors stepping in, look at strategic, look at the investments you want to make into a new company, into a venture. Well, it gives you the support that these guys can be up and running on day one. They don't need your money. Sit on that cash for a bit and wait.
Approvals can come later. You just start your work now.
I think someone mentioned an interesting statistic, right? That to start up a business, you need, 38?
38 is an understatement. You
need more than 38, and it takes at least six months.
Yeah, it takes six months, and that's just basic approvals. Some of them are uncanny, but they're still around. Another message they said is we will continue and try and do away with redundant legislations, which is good. We're over-legislated in India. We're under-implemented. Let's focus on those measures, right? So what they do, the two big ones that I saw on the regulatory side and something we've really appreciated is, one, the first one they said, they went and amended, or rather they suggested an amendment to the Foreign Exchange Management Act, where they said, look, Section 6 earlier told you that you can go out there and if anything needs to be amended on or any call needs to be taken, the power to regulate is with the RBI in consultation with the central government. Now, that reading was not ideal because anyway, this power to regulate transactions that were of capital accounts nature should have been a policy measure. It should have always been with the central government, and RBI should have been merely an implementing arm for this, right? But this is where we were. We've seen so many cases, and I'm sure you're aware, where there's an amendment out, but the RBI legislation or the RBI guideline has not been amended. We're waiting to see things. You know, Shreya took the example of increasing that limit of LRS to 250K. Well, it's out. There's a notification out there that says you're back to 250K a year. But again, we're waiting for the other authority to act upon it. So that's good. We've said now, other than purely debt transactions, purely debt capital account transactions, the regulator will be the central government. The DICP will step in. So I think that's, again, it's a move towards single regulator in certain respects, and I think that's big. We've all waited for approvals when we're dealing with our foreign investors, whether it's on the entry side, on the exit side. So that quickens things up there, and I think is really a positive measure. RBI will only govern what is purely debt, and the fine print that I really enjoyed there was they said debt will be defined by the central government as well. So, you know, we're hoping that should, you know, pan out well. The other one, small measure but interesting, is they actually combined the caps for FDI, which are foreign direct investors, and FPI investors who are coming really through the portfolio route. So earlier, and now this is trickled down, it's not a big impact, but it shows what they're trying to, the message they're trying to send across. There are certain sectors like commodity exchanges, power exchanges, credit information companies, where there were separate caps laid out to how much you can invest in these sectors if you were an FDI investor or an FPI. Just taking the example of their power exchange. You know, it said 26% FDI is allowed, 23% FPI is allowed, and a net of 49. There wasn't much rationale as to why should 23 and 26 be there. We thought, is it control? Are they trying to keep negative control? But then one FPI is not getting to that limit. What's really the thought behind it? They've combined those. So I think it helps. It helps certainly, you know, if you're looking at some of these listed entities in this space, your FPI investors can go up to the limit that's being prescribed. Vice versa, this bifurcation goes away. So that was another one. And there are a few smaller ones on the regulatory side, but this is something we thought that was big. And the other one on the regulatory, and I say regulatory because banking finance space, the BFSI space in India is so regulated that it's probably regulatory measures only there. But two, three big ones there that we've seen big. Number one, I think the biggest problem we've seen in India is we've never had anything even close to a bankruptcy code in India, right? It was impossible to wind down companies. It was such a breathtaking, life-taking process to really wind something down. More importantly,
it takes about 10 years or something.
We've seen examples. It's taken 10 years and
you're
just sitting and there are approvals, and we can, of course, talk about the details why it took so long. More importantly, right, the Chapter 11 part of a bankruptcy, there was no really real measure for reconstruction. There are little measures at the RBI level where they said, okay, debt restructuring, what should we do about debt restructuring? Let's have a forum. Fair enough, it has its hits and misses there. But on the other side, you know, BIFR was something we had, which is a failure to say the least. It just didn't get the process going. We're going to have now, and it's been spelled out very clearly, a concrete bankruptcy code. It was based on a report. The report was released last August. We all saw the report. We saw an outline of what they should look like. Seems very robust. Part two of the report is due in a couple of months. So we're hoping that sooner than later, the bankruptcy code, which is, I think, very important, is going to be in there. That's a big one there. The one that I see, which is probably even bigger, is the protection on SARFACES. So for those not initiated here, SARFACES is a legislation we came out in 2002, which is really, the purpose of this legislation was twofold. It was on one side, let's give banks and financial institutions the ability to go ahead and enforce your security interests, go ahead, foreclose a mortgage without the court process, right? You're a lender sitting there, your loan's been defaulted, you are a secured lender, you should have the right to go out there and foreclose the mortgage. Something that was really needed. The second part was, of course, of this legislation was to bring in asset reconstruction companies, et cetera, and how they would work. So I think the latter still did take off with a few nuances here and there. But security enforcement was just made available to either banks or financial institutions. Yes, it had a provision there which said notified non-banking financial companies also, but no one ever got notified. Right? Now, today, if you look at the Indian market, the amount of debt that's coming through non-banking financial companies is huge. In fact, the entire what I call the tier two debt market, which is not high-rated companies revealing debt, was everything was through NBFCs. All the new sectors were through NBFCs. LBOs were getting financed through NBFCs, or rather are getting financed. What they've now said is if you're a critically sized, which is strategically important, 500 crore asset size, which is actually not so big, an NBFC of this size, you will get protection of the court, which means this, the minute there is a default, the minute you hit that, yes, I have a right under my contract to enforce security interests, there is a debt crystallization, due crystallization of debt, and more importantly, go ahead and foreclose on that mortgage, go and deal with those collateralized assets that you have without waiting for a court order that gives you permission to do it. I think it's going to turn around things fairly quick. Also, when you see a number of NBFCs trying to deal with this, the environment, the overall environment on debt and enforcement on debt in India is going to see a good high. Now, this also comes with a couple of other advantages, and unless you want to talk about those, is what it actually says is now these NBFCs can also securitize their assets, right? So if they have a pool of bad assets, they can sell it to an asset reconstruction company, which was earlier limited only to banks and FIs to do. It also gives the NBFCs the ability to acquire security receipts that have been issued by asset reconstruction companies. So it's really giving them a play, not only to deal with their own bad assets by either foreclosing on them or selling them down, but it's giving them the play to also be able to participate in this market if you think security receipts issued by securitization or ARC companies is something that interests you. So these, I thought, were big.
Just one more point, obviously, you know, obviously, it also allows you access to debt recovery tribunals, which are faster courts rather than going. So you still have to go through a court process, but the courts are really tribunals, which are really fast, as against the long-run Indian, you know, labor and time court process.
Yeah, I think a couple of other ones that we saw, and again, this is, you know, there, which we think, again, regulatory but very big. They've promised us to have a common grievance forum. Now, how that works, today, if you have a SEBI issue, yes, you can go to SAT, which is the appellate tribunal in SEBI with, you know, an appeal. But then that's about it. And SAT is also, to one extent, just the same regulator having another appellate body. If you had an issue with RBI, God help you to file a writ petition and say, give me my rights and let's do what we can do. But there really wasn't much of an appellate authority that was available. Also, the other issue that we saw often was one regulator took a position A, regulator took position B, and then what do you do? They promised us to have a common grievance redressal appellate body. All of these guys should be able to come together, appeals from them lying towards a single authority. That's something I think that's going to be big. Also, very subtly done, there's a very interesting boost in, you know, Richard, I know you and I were talking about this earlier today, to the insurance sector, which has come in a very, very different manner. What they've done is that, you know, just recently, about before the budget, they increased the foreign investment cap in the insurance sector from 26% to 49%. Now, this is a sector that is bursting on its seams. We're just waiting for people to invest in here, and there's so much potential. So 49 helps. But what they also did in the budget, and very subtly so, they said, look, you know, employees who are small employees, we have something in India called the ESIC, which is really a state insurance, and which said that employees with a frugal salary would actually were compulsory. The employers had to register with ESIC, and therefore the contribution that was made out of their salary to ESIC was the state insurance. But the state insurance had no teeth. Very frankly, it was impossible for people to get access to healthcare. You know, a survey showed that people who were really interested in healthcare in that category, everybody was either covered by some corporate insurance or was covered on their own on their insurances. What they've now said is that contribution, and will have the same tax benefits, can be made to private insurers as well. I think that's great. You're increasing the net for private insurers suddenly so many fold. And you can imagine with small salaries how many people are actually employed by India or probably not employed by the government and, you know, otherwise protected for their benefits. So that was a big one for the insurance sector that we saw, subtly done. But, you know, it's a sector that we're really waiting for it to open up. And I think this will be a good boost. You have more opportunities. It's just the access of insurance will be so much wider. I think that, yeah, I think coupled with that, there have been a few other minor measures which are always there in the budget, but they resonated well this time. You know, there's a mudra, as they call it, a M-U-D-R-A, which is basically to going to be this little bank, but a bank with a 20,000 crore government-funded corpus to really support medium and small undertakings. Now, that's big. Mudra also covers in its ambit these, you know, ventures, right, which you typically will back by VCs. So they are promoting entrepreneurship at the next level. The government itself will put in their funds and, you know, have a bank to support that. So I think that was another measure that's there. Smaller measures on the infrastructure as well, but we can, you know, you'll see that in the fine print.
So I think, the
message across is very positive as I look at it.
So I think, so I think that is big. I think creation of a supra-regulatory tribunal is probably big because people were... Regulators have discretion, and there was no chance of discretion. So now if you have an appellate tribunal, I think that will probably help a lot. There will be a commercial division to all the courts, which means that commercial disputes between parties, you know, will get access to faster courts and not the long, driven court process. I think a little bit on the regulatory side is that domestic funds, called as AIFs or alternative investment funds, will now be able to receive foreign capital directly. Earlier, an AIF, which was usually structured as a fund or a trust, could not receive foreign investment without prior approval, and that approval typically only came in sectors which had a positive spillover effect, like the venture capital side of it. But if you were, let's say, doing private equity kind of deals, or you were doing debt, you could not receive foreign investment. So as a result, you know, Indian fund managers or Indian GPs who want to tap on offshore capital were constrained to then set up offshore pooling vehicles where offshore capital would come in. So there would be an offshore vehicle for offshore investors, domestic vehicle for domestic investors. They both would together co-invest, and then we have the entire tax risk of the offshore vehicle being also being taxed in India and obviously having. So I think they've made all that simpler, and especially for the Indian GPs. So you can have an Indian domestic vehicle, foreign investment can directly come in there, and carriage structure and, you know, and everything becomes a lot more easier. You would see Category 2 AIFs, which can do on-stream, which can do onshore lending, kind of becoming more popular now because NBFCs or non-banking financial companies still had a lot of restrictions and RBI regulations. SEBI is a much more easier regulator in that sense. You can get foreign investment into, you know, let's say Category 2 AIFs, new domestic lending, easier cash structuring, lesser regulation and all of that stuff. So I think that has been, another big one. I think on the macro front, by 2016, we should have the GST regime kicking in, and that could have been possible only with this government because it requires support of both central and the states. So we have sales tax, service tax, VAT, stamp duty, and everything at the central and the state level. Octroi, you travel from one state to another state, there are different taxes. All of them will get merged into one GST. So And I think that in itself can kind of accelerate GDP growth by about 2% because it will extremely widen the tax base because of everyone, you know, because there will be keenness in everyone to pay GST just because they would get credit because GST is a really a value-added tax. So you would pay only tax on the value addition and there will be keenness in everyone to kind of pay GST to kind of claim the credits. So I think that could enhance the tax base like anything, and I think it should be resulting in at least a 2% kind of GDP growth. Expectations are around 16 to 27% of GDP GST. The sense is that it might be starting off around 27%, so you will expect a lot of trouble in the course of next year.
I think if you look at the overall picture, right, today if you look at VAT rates in Europe, they're in the range of, it would be between 15 to 25%, depending on the country you're looking at within Europe. And I think the real win for GST will be today what happens, right? If you have import of goods, there's customs duty. If you're selling goods, then VAT, but the value addition is only creditable within specific states. Right, so in India, every state has the right to levy VAT. So say you're selling a good from Maharashtra to Karnataka, you're paying tax on the inputs in Maharashtra and then paying tax on the sales in Karnataka. So effectively, although your tax rate is lower, your VAT rate may only be a 12.5%. But when you look at the aggregate taxes you're paying, it actually works out to a lot more. So 27% sounds really high. It's going to streamline a lot of stuff because now your service tax obligations, your sales tax or VAT obligations, customs obligations, all of them are going to be roped into the same system. So it's only if you're adding any value. So if you've bought inputs of, say, 10 rupees and you're selling a product for 15 rupees, the 27% is only going to be levied on the 5 rupees, right? So huge benefit. And in fact, I think you mentioned that it's expected to result in a double-digit increase to the GDP. So currently they're targeting an 8.5% growth rate in India. And I think once the GST is introduced, that's targeted to be in double digits, which if you look at the world economy today, who's achieving that kind of growth, right? So I would see this, in fact, this would be my biggest hit. Coming back to the gentleman at the back, I think this is probably one of the most positive.
You know, and also a very interesting number, right? When India is so undertaxed, our tax net is so sad, the official government number, they say only 22 or 23% of people pay direct, who should be paying direct taxes, are paying direct taxes, and they say on indirect tax the number is even smaller. I think 18 or 17.5 or 18
so,
was the number.
So they're actually only about 2.5% of our population is actually paying tax.
Whereas that number should today be 10.5%.
And a large percentage of them are salaried employees, right? Evidently, if you have a country where your salaried employees are contributing a significant percentage of tax and the corporates are not paying a significant percentage of tax, then, of course, it's hugely problematic to have, tax provisions which are unclear and uncertain and all of that. But there's something going wrong here. And I think the 25% is also being introduced from that perspective, that we will bring down tax rates. We will expand the exemptions available to salaried employees and to individuals, but at the same time, we will remove the exemptions that are available, the tax shields that are available to corporates, so that net-net, everybody ends up paying their fair share. And these are all rationalizing measures, which I think will give a boost to the economy ultimately.
You had a question?
I just was curious about the implementation of GST. The finance minister said is that by April or March 2015, they expect it to be completed or in effect.
That's correct.
Doesn't it require approval at the parliament?
So it would need a constitutional amendment, and you're absolutely correct. And if you've been following the budget over the last few years, every year they say we're going to introduce the GST very soon. And what's been holding it up is that under the constitution, the states have the right to levy sales tax. So tax on sale of goods is a state subject. And service tax and customs are levied at the center. And the question is, how do you integrate a regime that blends both of these and provide a credit regime that is acceptable to the states? So I'm not sure if you were following the VAT implementation in India when it happened, 2005, 2006 onwards, when it was being implemented. If you recall the way in which it was done, the center put together a model VAT legislation, right? And each state was left, to implement the legislation as part of its state laws. So this is similar to what happened in Europe with the VAT, right? They said we're going to have a model VAT legislation in place and every country has to adopt it. So the GST is a little more challenging than that because they want to provide credit for transactions between states. And what we hear is that the BJP has been making real inroads as far as negotiations with the states are concerned. And they've put together a model GST kind of bill, which is now being discussed and is in very advanced stages.
And that is why a higher GST for that, states are not.
Another thing that they've done, what they've done is, and this was, this is the part of the budget we don't really analyze, but we started off, the finance minister started off by saying that he's doubled almost the allocation of revenue that's going to go down to the states. So, if you're going to collect X and you're going to get a quantum of X from the center anyway, right, or what you've been doing, I think half the battle is won there.
I think it's
the state is worried about having that much money available, and if you're getting it from one pocket or the other, I think half the battle is anyway won, right?
Touching 42%.
42.
Almost,
today,
right?
This time, it's 42.
Which is massive.
Absolutely. 42% of total, we're talking about total collection on the fiscal side.
Maybe you have a question, Vibhuti, or we have done. Okay. Any other questions, I think, or... or any questions on the call?
We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on your touch-tone telephone. Participants are requested to use only handsets while asking a question. Anyone who has a question at this time may press star and one. Once again, please press star one to ask a question.
Okay.
And ladies and gentlemen, we have no questions at this time. I would like to hand the conference back over to
Ms. Right.
Shreya Rao for closing
right,
remarks.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nitesh Desai, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.